Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2017 Home Education Conference, held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
My name is David Glassett. I am a cartographer. That means I make maps. If you read my bio, it means that I don't take pictures of cars. I've actually had somebody ask me, you're a cartographer? Does that mean you take pictures of cars? Like a car and a photographer, so a cartographer? No, I make maps. And I thought, oh, okay. Haven't all the maps been made already? I said, well, I'm not discovering new places, but I'm making maps of different places. So, if you ask yourself, well, how can you make maps if they're already all been made? There's plenty of maps to be made out there, and we'll talk about that a little bit. So you should be in, without geography, you're nowhere. But now you're in geography, so you're everywhere. So we're going to have lots of bad puns today, probably because that's just kind of who I am with bad puns. So we're going to have three objectives today in terms of learning about what is geography and how you integrate geography into a homeschooling world. Because really, you're probably already doing it and you're just not aware of what geography is. I think a lot of people think geography is, I've got to memorize all the countries in Africa and know what their capital is, and then I've learned geography and I'm good and I can move on. And if you can't identify all the countries in Africa, then you haven't learned your geography. And guess what? I make maps for a living, and I can name most of the countries in Africa, but probably not all of them. And their capitals, I would get jumbled up. So geography is so much more than just states and capitals and countries and their capitals. So that's the learning aspect of geography. And then at the very end, we'll talk about resources that we've used with our six children, four of whom are school age, in learning geography. And you know what those can do in terms of the excitement and love of the world that we have, that we live in, and it's such a great place. So first I want to talk about how geography is everywhere. You're in any subject matter that you're already teaching, geography is integrated into it. So a couple examples using some of my favorite things, which are maps. So if any of you read books, I'm assuming some of you might, there's geography integrated into all of it. I just chose The Chronicles of Narnia. We've read this with our kids, maybe more than once. I know some of our kids have read it on their own more than once. But there's a whole geography to this world that the children, the Pevensey children, go into. And so if you wanted to yourself, you could create your own map of Narnia and all the lands around Narnia, or they've already got it in the back of the book, and you can use it there. So you know, you follow them on their adventures. I personally love reading nonfiction, and so when you learn about a person, like biographies of people, you always look for, I always look for the map. Like, well, they grew up here, and then they went here, and you kind of get oriented spatially in their life so that you can also orient yourself chronologically in their life. And it's such an integral part of that learning process. So geography is also integrated into biology. And just one example is the range of animals. So I love whales. I think they're a fascinating animal. And so here is the range of blue whales. Everything that's blue on that map is where a blue whale lives. So pretty much anywhere but the Arctic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. But you could do this for any animal, and you could see where they live. I have on my phone the Audubon bird app. And so I was on a camp out with my 11-year-old son the other day, and they had to identify 10 different types of animals. And so we see this bird, and I'm like, well, is that a crow, or is that a raven, or what kind of blackbird is this? So then I learned that, oh, ravens don't live in Virginia. They live in the West. So anyone who's a Baltimore Ravens fan, it's all a lie. Sorry. So history is one of the biggest places where you find geography and the need for understanding geography and why people have done things where they have done things. So this is a map that I made of the route of the Mormon Battalion. It's a long story I won't tell. but I made it for the Mormon Battalion Visitor Center, and they don't use it, so I use it. Why did the Mormon Battalion march where they did? And there's a whole host of geography associated with that that you can look into. You talk about astronomy, and geography is really important in astronomy. So you may be wondering why I have pictures of flags on a slide about astronomy. So the top flag is Australia. Anybody know what the bottom flag is? No? Samoa. So this is the flag of Samoa, and the two things they have in common is that constellation. Anybody know what that constellation is? The Southern Cross. Has anyone ever seen the Southern Cross in the sky? You weren't here when you saw it, were you? Where were you when you saw it?
Fiji.
You got to be in, you got to be further south to see the Southern Cross. And so geography is important in things like astronomy. Now, when you think about geography, there are five themes that we in the world of geography learn about in school, but are real applicable ways of thinking about the realities of geography in our everyday life. So I'm going to go through these five themes. And think about, as you are working with your children or in your homeschooling environment, how do these five themes play into the things that we do? So the first of the five themes is location. And location can be broken down into two things. You have absolute location and you have relative location. So first of all, what is absolute location? You get some sort of, absolute's kind of a definitive word, right? What do we mean? So absolute location is something that is measured. So we break the world into these lines and grids and stuff, and the most common is latitude and longitude. We've all heard about latitude and longitude, but we never remember which one's which. Do I'm going around the Earth? Is that latitude or longitude? I always remember the lines that go across on a map is latitude, and that's the one that has an A. So A across latitude, that's how I remember. But those are the measures north and south of the equator. Longitude is east and west of the prime meridian. Why is the prime meridian going through London? Because London was the seat of power in the world when the prime meridian was invented, when we said we need a place for a standard to start at zero, because I could go around and around the Earth and keep going. I just need to define one place as zero. So London was the seat of power, and so they defined London as zero. So this is our latitude and longitude right here. We have measured our location pretty absolutely. I included six significant digits on those measures of latitude and longitude. There are different ways that you can display latitude and longitude. So you've got degrees, minutes, and seconds. That's what you have, those three parts on the top. And then you can convert those into a decimal. And those two things say the same thing. So there are other ways that you can measure. There's something called Universal Transverse Mercator Grid System. So the world's broken up in 6-degree segments. So you've got 66-degree segments around the world. We happen to be in zone 18 north because it starts going from west all the way to east. And then in each zone, you have to go east and north on the grid system. So if you really needed to measure yourself in UTM, you could do that. That's another way to measure absolute location. And then there's this fun thing called What Three Words. And they have divided the Earth into 3-meter by 3-meter segments. There's like 7 trillion of them or something like that. So if you imagine the space where I am standing is 1 3-meter by 3-meter segment, and you're probably sitting only next to maybe one other person in a 3-meter by 3-meter segment. That's how fine of a detail that these are. And each 3-meter by 3-meter segment has 3 words associated with it. And so I didn't know at the time exactly what room I would be in, but I chose a place relatively somewhere in the conference center. And the 3 words of that location were dumpling coiled ladder. Latter, L-A-T-T-E-R. I thought that was appropriate. I didn't plan that, latter. And so you can say, if you're like at a fair and you are at the funnel cake booth, and your friend is somewhere else in the fair, and you're like, come get these funnel cakes. They are really, really good. They're like, where are you? Well, I, you know, if you go kind of down and turn at the cotton candy, and then, like, the guy that was, you know, doing the hammer hit where you try to hit the bell, you got to take a ride there, and but there's so many people, I'll wave my hand, but you might not see me. Well, if you both have the What Three Words app, you could say, well, I'm at Apple Pear Peach, and come find me. You put in Apple Pear Peach, and you know exactly where they are.
Is there any, like is the next square totally different words?
Yep. Okay, yep. So they're
no,
totally
like,
different words.
No sense at all.
Yeah, only similar words are on the other opposite side of the globe, and so you, they know kind of where you're going. Yeah?
How accurately can you pinpoint yourself?
3 meters by 3 meters. As long as your phone, as long as the GPS on your phone is turned on to high fidelity,
oh, okay.
It's...
Wow.
Yeah, it's going to know.
Is it language specific?
Like, they,
France,
I think.
Are they French words?
No, they're all English. Well, yes. I think they do some language. I don't know how many languages they have it in. But I know they have a contract with the country of Mongolia's postal service because Mongolia's addressing service is really poor. I mean, you get out in the country and you kind of call the person on their phone. You're like, how, are you there? Can I get to you? So Mongolia has actually signed up with What Three Words to use this as their addressing system in the country. So that's What Three Words. They're kind of a private company doing this absolute location thing in a different way that we haven't thought about before. So relative location is what is your location in relationship to other things? So we're here in Williamsburg. There's a beautiful map of Black Virginia and here's Williamsburg. In relation, we're in between two major rivers coming up out of the Chesapeake, or going down into the Chesapeake, I guess. In relation, we're in eastern Virginia, or southern Virginia, southeastern Virginia. You can say we're on the Atlantic coast. That is a relative location. You can say we are south of Canada. That's a relative location. There's an infinite number of relative locations we can give, and it's just a matter of what is meaningful to you in terms of relative location. So that's the first theme. The second theme is place. Place takes location and brings it inside yourself, and what does that place mean to me? And that is still part of geography. So, for example, you might take a hike as a family, and you could talk about, well, where did we go on our hike? Well, we went to the Shenandoah National Park. Like, okay, well, that's a place that's more of kind of an absolute location in terms of this place has a name, and you could pinpoint where exactly where the trail was and everything. Well, he said, well, what was the hike like? Well, it was really steep and hilly at the beginning, but there were lots of trees, and their wildflowers were pretty cool. And this place starts to have a sense of meaning to you. And that is an important part of your interaction with geography. So this is a place in Wyoming called Peaceful Valley. So Peaceful Valley Maps is named after Peaceful Valley, Wyoming, where my wife's family has some land. And this is the outline of the land. So this is a place that has a lot of meaning to us. And so the geography of the place, you get to know the mountains and the hills and the paths and, you know, where the trees are, because there's not a ton of trees, as you can see. But it's a place that has meaning. And so you can start asking your children, you know, what does that place mean to you? And have them describe the feeling that they get when they're in a particular location. And you don't have to think of this in as any sort of big sense. The place could be their bedroom. I mean, there is a geography to somebody's bedroom just as much as there is a geography to the city you live in or the state you live in. Yeah?
I just have a success story that I'd like to share about geography.
Sure.
And meaningful places. We got a list of all of the temples in construction and built in the world, right? And I had my two youngest kids, they're 10 and 11, right? And so we had a paper world map on the wall. And we had Google Maps on the phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we would, when you go through the temples, you go alphabetically, and so it sends you all over the world. You're like from Auburn, Nigeria to Anchorage,
Alaska. You're jumping.
And so they just raced, you know, who could find it first on the paper map, you know, quicker on the paper map or on the Google Maps. Paper was always faster. But anyway, it was fun. You know, you're scrolling across the Pacific Ocean trying to find Samoa.
Fiji, you know, or any of those, trying to find the temples.
It was a really cool geography.
That is really neat. In fact, our son the other day, he has a paper world map taped to the wall. He's on a bunk bed, and he's the lower bunk. So he's got this map kind of taped underneath. He was going to bed. He's the one that likes to stay up as late as he can. And he had a flashlight flashing on the wall, and he had a book. I don't know if it's like an almanac or kind of book. And he was looking to see the list of the name of the country and its capital in the book. And he was looking at the map because it was a pretty new map. And he just wanted to make sure that the book was still accurate, to make sure that the country and its capital hadn't changed between, you know, when that book was printed and today. Mm-hmm. So it was the same sort of discovery. The third theme is human-environment interaction. And so how do humans work with or be affected by the environment around them, the geography that's around them? You can think of this in lots of different ways. So here is five of our six children. This was a road trip we were on a couple years ago, and I thought it would be cool if we drove to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. All right, so here is, you've seen a couple things of interaction. Here we are with coats on because it was cold in northern Michigan in July. It didn't get above like 55 degrees that day, and it was in the middle of summer. But you also see a very, very large bridge behind us. In fact, it's the largest suspension bridge in the Western Hemisphere. That is the Mackinac Bridge, and it goes from the southern half of Michigan to the northern half of Michigan, connecting the lower and upper peninsulas. And so that is how humans have decided to interact with their environment to get from one place to another. They've built a bridge. There are multiple ways we could have done that, I suppose. We could have built a tunnel. We could have taken ferry boats across. There could have been a lot of things, but that was the manner in which we have interacted with our environment. Your environment affects what you wear. It affects whether or not you take the umbrella with you that day. It affects how you go to the park. If there is one way that you walk to the park and it's strewn with lots of beautiful flowers that time of year, you may take your children that way rather than down the dirt path where they might get super dirty and you don't want to, you know, have to track that mud back into the house or something. There are different ways that you interact with the world around you, and that is an important part of geography. The fourth theme is movement. How do things and why do things get from one place to another? So this could be the movement of goods. My wife's cousin created a board game called the Jane Game, which is all about Jane Austen, and it's a trivia game about Jane Austen. And so she had a Kickstarter campaign, and she was really excited about it, and it got funded. And so they were made in Korea or China over in Asia. But the games had to get from there to the United States so that she could distribute them to all of her supporters from the Kickstarter campaign. And it took a long time, right? Everything had to be packed up, put in a container ship. And so all these people who are eagerly awaiting the arrival of the Jane game had to wait because it had to go on a container ship. It had to move across the Pacific Ocean. And then once it got into port, it had to wait in port because that's the way shipping containers work, is that you just kind of wait for it to be done, for that time for it to be unloaded. So here is that map of the route of the Mormon battalion. Why did they move the way they did? Well, first of all, they followed an established trail. They started on the Santa Fe Trail, and so it was a lot easier to move on a trail that's already established. And then they had to cut their own trail from Santa Fe to San Diego. And they went through all sorts of places, trying to get access to water, trying to make sure that they could cut a wagon road. That was the task that the Army had given them, was to cut a wagon road. And so they had to go up and down and around places where wagons could go. They even blasted through a canyon wall that was too narrow for a wagon. So they had to blast through the canyon wide enough for a wagon to get through, because there was no other way around that choke point. This is a movement map that I made of our Great Western Road Trip in 2016. So we live up in Reston, Virginia, and we kind of made a loop counterclockwise around, and so that was just a fun exercise, a little journaling map that I made to show the movement that our family had around the country. So the fifth theme is region. And if you think about the way that we cluster ourselves, we like to generally be around people who are like us. Well, geography is the same way. There is a professor from University of California, Santa Barbara, his name's Waldo Tobler, who created the first law of geography. So if you ask anybody who is studying geography at an academic level, ask them, what's the first law of geography? And if they don't know it, their professors would be mad at them. So the first law of geography is this. All things are like each other, but near things are more like each other than far things. So the nearer you are to something, the more likely you are to be similar to it than something that's farther away from you. So for example, let's take language. So if you think about languages throughout the world, one of the most common languages is Chinese. There are a lot of people who speak Chinese. Well, where are the people who speak Chinese? In China, mostly, and then some scattered pockets. You don't have a small pocket of Chinese speakers in southern Africa, and then a small pocket in Central Europe, and then a small pocket in the Amazon, and another small pocket in Canada, and all these small pockets turn out to be, the most spoken language in the world. No, there's a dense concentration of people, a region of Chinese speakers in China, and then where those people have moved to, movement, remember that, that's another theme of geography, where those speakers have moved to, you get other pockets in cities and things like that around the world. So you may be familiar with this region, which is the percent of Latter-day Saints per county in the 2000 census. So this is the Mormon region, right? It's the area where there is a heavily Latter-day Saint population. You got Utah, southeastern Idaho, bleeding down into Arizona and into Nevada, and you kind of have a general light pinkish sort of feel in the western United States, and then kind of fades off. There are some, Vermont seems to have a strange density of Latter-day Saints. I don't know why. It's kind of pink. There's just not a lot of people. Yeah. So this afternoon, I am going to speak to the youth as well. And the title of my presentation to them is How Maps Lie. That was kind of a kitschy title, I know, because I wanted to attract the attention of the youth mostly. But there's a great book called How to Lie with Maps by Mark Monmanier, who's a professor at Syracuse University. And it's kind of based off of How to Lie with Statistics, which was another book written many years ago. But I wanted to tell you and talk to you a little bit about the way maps are made and the things that cartographers do in creating them that you need to know about to understand what you are seeing and what they could be, what could be affecting how you read the map. It is true that all maps lie. It's true, but they're mostly just white lies, we like to think. But they're necessary for the way that the map is made. So the first way that maps lie is in projection. A projection is how we get a globe, which is a three-dimensional object, onto a two-dimensional flat surface, whether that's a piece of paper or a screen or whatever it is that we're seeing the map. There's some way that the 3D, the world we live in, has to be affected. So all projections distort what we're seeing. What you see on a flat map is not what the world really looks like. And they distort it in one of four ways. The first and probably most commonly understood is area. So the actual area comparisons between one landmass to another. So if you look at this map, it's called a Mercator projection, named after a guy from the 1600s or 1500s. Area has been distorted. So this is maybe one of the most common classroom style maps. It's nice, rectangular, which really was helpful in creating a poster of it. And it has some good uses, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But I've put Greenland and Africa kind of in a darker gray. So I want you to compare those two, the sizes of those two land masses. So raise your hand if you think Greenland appears larger than Africa. Okay, so pretty much everyone thinks Greenland appears larger than Africa. I will tell you that area is grossly distorted in this projection. So the reality here is that is the true area comparison of Greenland to Africa. Raise your hand if you think Greenland appears larger than Africa. Nobody. So Greenland's actually like a tenth the size of Africa. But because of the projection that was chosen, the way that we had to get this 3D Earth onto a flat screen, it distorted the area. But if you project it in a different way, then the area is preserved. Now, the shapes are a lot different. If you compare the two shapes, so look at the shape of Greenland here and the shape of Greenland there, there's a different shape. If you were to try to replicate and draw those shapes, Greenland's kind of slanted here in this projection, but it was more straight up and down in the previous projection. So we'll talk about shape. That's a different thing that you can choose. But all these projections have to do with math. Lots of trigonometry going on how to get a spherical object projected onto a flat screen or a flat piece of paper. So the shape is the second one. This Mercator projection that we had earlier, this is the true area. Remember, this is called Mollweide projection. This is a true area, but we distorted the shape. But if we go back to that Mercator, this is actually how the shapes are. If you look on a globe, and a globe preserves all four of these attributes, this would be the shape that Greenland is. You've just kind of enlarged it a lot. And that's the true shape of Africa. But we've distorted the area. So you can preserve area, you could preserve shape, you could also preserve distance. So if I wanted to measure how far is it from one place to another, most projections you could make that measurement, but it would be wrong. There would be some error in that measurement because distance is distorted. So here we're back to that Mercator projection. So if I wanted to measure the distance from Williamsburg to Rome, and we plotted those on the map, you would just say, oh, of course, I'll just draw a straight line, right? A straight line is the shortest distance between two points. Everybody learned that in geometry? Yeah. Straight line is the shortest distance between two points. Well, guess what? The actual shortest distance between Williamsburg and Rome is represented in this projection. Oh, I don't have it there. Okay, I think it comes up later, sorry. Represented in this projection, which is an equidistant projection. Sometimes we're not creative in the way that we name it, but it makes it simple. So usually the only kind of projection that will preserve distance is when you have one place in the middle of your projection, and the distance to any other place on that projection from the center point will be preserved. So I had to create a special projection. I made my own projection. Isn't that cool? I had to create a special projection with Williamsburg in the middle, so now I can measure that distance. If I know what the scale of that map is, a numerical scale of 1 to 40 million or whatever, then I could calculate, if the line that I measure is 3 inches long, I can do the math to figure out what the actual distance is. So direction will have also a distorted effect if not done correctly. So Robinson projection is a very popular world projection named after Arthur Robinson, who was a professor at the University of Wisconsin, a great geography school if your child is interested in geography. And he created his own projection. It's a nice world projection, and it's used a lot. National Geographic used it for a long time as their world projection of choice. But it's what we call a compromise projection, where it doesn't preserve anything. Areas are distorted, distances are distorted, shapes distorted, and direction is distorted, but they're all distorted as little as possible. So instead of preserving one at the great expense of another, they've tried to kind of compromise on everything. So if we were to make an angular measurement from Williamsburg to London, and I were to measure that angle and say, if I want to fly from Williamsburg to London, I should set a compass course of 45 degrees or whatever my measurement is, then if I tried to do that, I would not end up in London. I would end up somewhere else in the world. But back to this Mercator thing that we all love to hate, it actually preserves direction. This was incredibly useful to sailors. This was the projection that they would use. If they wanted to sail from London to Williamsburg, they could set their angular measurement, and they say, we know that we have to maintain a bearing of 125 degrees, and then go. And they could, as long as they knew that their compass was set to that bearing and they were staying true to that bearing, they would hit where they wanted to go. But remember, that was the direction they would go. It wouldn't be the shortest route, right? Because we haven't preserved distance. We've only preserved direction. So it would take them a little bit longer, but they would get there. That's actually the shortest route between London and Williamsburg. But you think, how can that be? Well, it's because of the projection we chose. We didn't preserve distance, we preserved direction. So that's the true direction, and you can measure it, but that's the true shortest distance between London and Williamsburg. So based on the projection that your cartographer chooses for you, you haven't chosen the projection. You have to understand that they have hopefully chosen that projection to best optimize the story that's being told.
So on that last slide,
yeah,
the distance between Williamsburg and London appears to be a curved line, but is it in actuality on a globe more of a straight line?
It would be a perfectly straight line on a globe.
And then
yep.
the other route that looks straight on the map is actually a curved line going down on the globe. Okay.
Yep. So if you were to fly from Williamsburg to London, what they would do is they call it a great circle route. It's a line that cuts through the center of the Earth. So it's a straight line on a globe that cuts through the center of the Earth. That's the shortest distance between any two places. But based on the math that's done for this particular projection, it ends up looking like a curved line.
So it is curved because the plane has to go up and come back down, right? So it's a parabola, right?
It's curved in that way, sure. So the second way that maps lie is this thing that we call generalization. So it's taking the data that's shown on the map and how are we going to make it more general. So there's a couple ways we can do this. One is by simplifying the information, and the other is by symbolizing the information. So on this map that we're showing of the Warmer Battalion route, there are a lot of things that could be shown here. I could have shown a lot more water courses, a lot more rivers. There are lakes there. I used to live in Texas, and there were teeny lakes all over Texas. I could have shown those. I could have shown more trails. I could have shown the roads that exist here. I could have shown anybody live within the frame of this map. I could have shown your house, right? I didn't show your house.
What?
See, I could have shown lots of stuff, but because that stuff wasn't pertinent to the story, I had to simplify it by taking it out. I didn't want you to become distracted by the story that was trying to be told by the map, so I had to simplify it. So just understand that the cartographers made lots of choices to simplify. This is another map I made for the Kirtland Visitor Center. They actually do use it. So if you ever go to Kirtland and they give you a map to get around to some of these historic sites, this is it. But if you look, I mean, there are a lot of stuff. It's a very simple, like, black and white line map with a few roads. If you drive that route that goes from the John Johnson Farm, which is kind of off of the zoom-in section, up to Kirtland, there are tons of roads that you're going to pass that I didn't put on there because I wanted you to focus on stay on this road until I, stay on 44 North until I get to U.S. Highway 6, and that's when I have to turn. I don't want you distracted by other little farm roads, and you put a little, some key markers, some key large intersections on there so that you know kind of what progress you're being made. But there's a lot that's on there. Just realize that the cartographer had to make a choice. They had to take things out because there's so much complexity in the world, we can't show it all. But also critically think, is there something in this map that should be there that isn't? And just know that, you know, be able to think critically about what the map is showing you. So the next way that maps lie is data classification. So we have a whole, you know, big database that somebody wants us to put on a map. So for Rand McNally, that big database is roads. And what do I do with roads, and how do I put them on the map? I could just put them all on there, and they could be big, thick black lines, and you'd have no idea what to do, because there would just be this spider web of big, thick black lines. But in Rand McNally's wonderful way, they have decided to classify those roads based on some sort of data set. You could classify them by the speed limit, you could classify them by the number of lanes, you could classify them by how they're paved or not, you could classify them by the amount of traffic that drives on them. There's lots of ways that you can classify these roads. So they've classified them in this method, meaning we're going to classify them by highway and break that classification on free versus toll. And then we're going to classify them by, you know, other highways, principal highways, down to other roads and unpaved roads, hopefully in a way that helps you use their road atlas. So just understand that as you're looking at a map, there's a way to classify data. And there's not always a right way or a wrong way. In fact, most of the times, there is no right way versus wrong way. The right or wrong is based on how you want to use that data and use that information. So when you're reading the newspaper or you're looking at a blog and they've got a map on there, you can think, well, what did they do with this data? How did they classify it? Why did they classify it that way? Is there a better way that they could have classified it? And then how did they display that data?
Can I say something too on that?
Yeah.
This last year we've had annual passes to Colonial Williamsburg, mm-hmm. and we've loved it. And it was really interesting what you say, what they put on and what they don't put on, because we have the book, we have the fold out of all the houses. And it looks like there's maybe 13 houses on the street, but that's because those are the only houses that are the historically correct and accurate that are open to the public.
Right.
But when you get there, it's just like you're saying, to look at it critically. I think this is a really great point to teach our kids critical thinking skills, because there's all these other houses. And then my kids would say, well, what are the rest of these houses?
Why are they not on the map?
Hotels. We've learned that they're still private lodgings from people who have lived there that have not outlived their deed, whatever access that they've done, and also people who work there live there. We've talked to some of them. So I think that's a great point. You know, this is a great idea, the whole class, is that it teaches you to think critically about the world around them in a very useful way, in a very everyday way. So,
and how would you do it? Right? That's a fun exercise of taking somebody has chosen to do it this way.
Right.
Well, if we take that same data set, how would you do it and how would you show it?
And what's not there.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I love the idea of how maps lie, and that's an image that we see, and we can also extend that to our children of any image that the world puts in front of us. How has someone else classified something so that this X, Y, and Z is important?
Yeah.
Where really what's important to us as a family is A, B, and C.
Right.
So you can just look at all the different levels that you did, like how is that distorted? How is, you know, this image that the world puts in front of us?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. That's a great cross application. So in the guidebook, I have on page 103, lots of different teaching resources, and they fall into one of three different categories. I just broke them down. So the first is computer-based, the second is maps and atlases, and the third is games and books. And there are lots of other resources, and I would love to hear what your ideas for some of those resources are. I'll just share a few that we've used. In terms of computer-based, our kids spend a lot of time on Google Maps. They just explore the world. You can use the Street View function, where the little Google car is driven around lots of places in the world, and you could just be immersed in Paris, or in South Africa, or in the Amazon jungle. They've had like the little Google camera go down the Amazon River, and you've got all sorts of amazing photos of places. And so, you know, you don't have to travel to all those places to understand what's it like there. What do the street signs look like? What do the people look like? What do the shops look like? What does the countryside look like? What do the farms look like? So they spend a lot of time in Google Maps. In relation to that is this website called geoguessr.com. It's in the guidebook. There's not a typo. If you look at it, it looks like GeoGuessr, and it looks like there's an E missing on the ER at the end. That's not a typo. That's actually how the website is spelled. So it's some Swedish IT developer guy who's kind of taken all these Street View images, and you get dropped somewhere in the world, and you have to put a pinpoint on the map to guess where you are, and you get points based on how close you are. You can drive around the scene and try to figure out, you look for clues, like, is there a country flag somewhere that I can see? Am I in the city or the countryside? What's the climate like where this place is? Are they driving on the left-hand side of the road or the right-hand side of the road? All sorts of clues that you get picked up on. Worksheetworks.com is a great place for map worksheets. That son who was with the flashlight, he's on a kick of, he wants to do like every state in the United States. And so every morning he gets a new state and he has to fill in. You have to identify, different features, cities, rivers, neighboring states and countries. And he loves it and he thinks it's great. And so he'll sit there with the road atlas and with the little worksheet, and he'll just kind of have a great time in the morning figuring that out. So those are more of the computer-based resources. I, not surprisily, am a huge component of having actual maps and atlases on hand. I tried to count before I came how many atlases we have in our house, and I forget now. It's like 7 or 8. Road atlases, world atlases, children's atlases. We love the Reader's Digest Children's Atlas of the World. It is out of print, but we keep finding it at used bookstores, and we need to keep finding it because it gets worn out and all the pages start falling out. Either that or need to learn bookbinding, one of the two. So we love it. It's great. It's got little pictures of things that happen and are done in each country.
Just because you don't have it on the list, we have the Barefoot Books Atlas.
Barefoot.
They're actually cool. Here. I didn't realize they were going to be here.
Oh, we'll go,
it's
I'll
good
go look at it.
For young children, it's really beautiful. Yeah. It's just really nice introduction to the world. It's just, there's animals on it.
Yep.
It's just really interesting.
There are lots of options, and yeah. That's just the one that we have found, but I'm not saying it's the best.
I would say younger than that. It's just a nice little children introduction.
That's great. Cool. Very cool. I will highlight that we have a very, very large world map on one wall. It's probably like 8 feet by 6 feet or 5 feet or something like that. And we also have a very large U.S. map on our dining room wall. I put the specific U.S. map on there if you're interested. It's a really, 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 really fantastic map. It is really good. I like it. It's won all sorts of awards. It's got a level of detail that you see, the more you see, the closer you look. If you look at it from far, it's a nice map of the United States, but there is so much detail in the way that they've done the roads, the boundaries, and the rivers, and the number of cities that are on there. Every time we have missionaries come over, they're like, oh, where are you from? They're like, oh, I'm from such and such place. I'm like, oh, we'll go look on the map, see if it's there. Oh, it's not there. It's a small town. And we go look on the map, and 9 times out of 10, their small town is on the map. So it's a lot of fun. And then the third is games and books. I have invented a game called State Quizzers. It uses this U.S. map, and so I'll have them guess what state I'm thinking of, which is a fun because they've broken the logic down. They know that half the states are east of the Mississippi, half the states are west of the Mississippi. So they'll kind of do this logical breakdown of figuring out what state it is based on geography. And then I'll just ask questions. Geography-based, history-based, if I know anything historical about the state. It could be entertainment-based, Tennessee. I'll ask them about Elvis sometimes, what city was Elvis from? Or all sorts of things. You just use your own knowledge of the state, or you can pull an almanac. I've taken an almanac off the shelf and just, you know, kind of figured out some facts about the state. And it's just a fun game, and we expose the missionaries to it every time they come over for dinner. And I think the kids like to see the missionaries squirm in their seats about not knowing geography. We'll often give the missionaries a state quiz around their own state. Some of them feel pretty confident about their own state. And some of them were, and some of them weren't. And so it's fun. But there's lots of puzzles and games and things like that that are really good for learning geography. I put a few, again, that we've used. We really love Scrambled States of America, which is both a book and a card game. Pretty entertaining. For older children, like, you know, fourth, fifth grade on, and for adults, there's a great book called How the States Got Their Shape. And if you ever wanted to know why there's a little notch out of Massachusetts into Connecticut, then you'll know why. If you ever want to know why the boundary between Mississippi and Alabama isn't a straight line but actually goes straight and then bends a little bit, then you'll know why. And if you ever wanted to, you know why there's these little quirky boundaries and, you know, between states, he goes through all the history of how these states got their boundaries. And there's a lot of U.S. history and politics and how the U.S. political system works that gets thrown into that book. So it's a fantastic book. It's not necessarily something you sit down and just read cover to cover. You kind of get interested in one state, and you're like, oh, wow, Michigan is really amazing how, you know, they got the Upper Peninsula, and there's this whole war about Toledo and all sorts of stuff. Did you have a question?
I was just going to add, comment? For some learners, How the States Got Their Shapes is also a TV series that some kids do better with the visual, you know. And there's also a game that we enjoy that has different regions covered. It's 10 Days in the USA or 10 Days in Africa. It's a travel game, and if you play it frequently, they get very comfortable with the map of that region.
Yeah.
So you have to navigate, you know, like a road trip.
Yeah, so 10 days in
USA,
whatever region. There are several of them, right?
I think there are four. So.
That's great. Thanks, Anne. There's lots of games, like train. What's that train game?
Yeah, Ticket to Ride.
Thank you. Ticket to Ride. Very map-based. Lots of those games are very map-based.
Some of those projections and maps that you made, is it possible for like a high school student to break into that, or is that too advanced?
For a high school student, absolutely. There is open source mapping software. There's one called QGIS, Q-G-I-S. And so you can download it and use. There's a learning curve to it, but they have I have tutorials and things like that on using geographic data, getting that geographic data, and they have examples and problems that they can use. But GIS, which is Geographic Information Systems, it's a software tool for taking geographic data and creating maps out of it. Yeah?
Did you use that program to make your map journal?
Yeah, so like the road trip map. So professional cartographers generally use the Adobe Creative Suite as kind of their finishing product. So they'll take that GIS software and export it into an Adobe Illustrator file. That's why I actually made it in Adobe Illustrator. But you could make that using QGIS. I'm curious what other resources that you have used in teaching geography, or any other questions you have. Oh, cool.
And it has a full-length video on each state.
Aerial America. Are they available online?
So I bought it on Amazon. I don't have cable, so I don't have the Smithsonian channel. But you can buy the whole video series on Amazon, and it's like $70-some.
Very cool.
And it's 50 full-length videos. They have one on each state. And they're really well done, a lot of history about each state. And the scenery is just fabulous because they take a lot of the video from
Yep.
And you can
Aerial America.
And what the state looks like, and they talk about the different cities and the history of the states. It's
very cool.
It's fabulous, very well done.
Thank you. Is there another hand over here? Yeah, go ahead.
This is a free, fun resource. We have been using this YouTube channel called Geography Now.
Geography Now on YouTube.
Funny guy. He's like a college student who just travels the world. And he makes these hilarious videos about every country he goes to. And they're like 10 minutes long. And he covers the flag and the people and the geography and the political tensions. And
right.
It's fun.
Yeah. That's very cool.
I will tell you, in that one, in the Afghanistan videos, he calls everything Afghani. And that's incorrect.
It is incorrect.
We haven't got there yet.
Afghan is money. We had a good laugh in our geography class about that.
That is hilarious. Did we have one more?
I was just going to mention a couple apps.
Sure.
There's one called Stack the States. And
Stack the States.
Same designer did Stack the Countries.
Okay. And Stack the Countries.
Stack the States. It's just spelled how it sounds. And you're literally stacking the states, and they kind of topple because they're the shape that they are. And you have to strategize where to put them, and you know, Rhode Island doesn't belong in certain places. And
right, you don't.
Jenga for the first to get the state.
Right. It's a progressive game, and, you know, it's really cool to watch. You know, certain kids really get into that, and it's kind of competitive, but with themselves, like familiarizing with where the state belongs on the map versus
right.
how to stack it. Anyway, it's really great.
Very cool. Stack the shape, stack the states, and stack the countries.
I'm sitting here trying to find it. Maybe somebody else knows about it. I can't remember the name. It's an Instagram account that I follow that the children love that it's He's a photographer, and it's all aerial views of places all over the world, and he just published a book. Does anyone know I'm talking? I'm trying to find it so I can share with you.
Oh, okay.
But it's really fascinating. He talks.
Is it Earth from Above?
No.
But that's been out for a while. That's an awesome book. But
yeah.
He went around and took pictures from his ultralight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much geographic, it's more topography.
Which is geography.
Right. Yeah, but you know what I'm saying? It's not like boundaries and that.
It's all geography.
It's all political geography.
Yeah, you've got gorgeous. Physical geography, you've got political.
We have a coffee table book that's that. And
oh, very cool.
Gorgeous.
Very cool. And that's the kicker, I think, in the very end is if you were to go to the American Association of Geographers conference that they hold every year, it's a huge, huge, huge conference. You have so many subsets of political geography and how political entities interact with each other throughout the world and how geography affects that. You have human geography, you have physical geography, and you know why is it wet on the western side of Washington but dry on the eastern side of Washington? That's a geographic problem to solve, and it's all solved by geography. And so as you're going through your homeschooling or just your own personal exploration of the world, just understand that geography really is everywhere. And it incorporates all sorts of different facets of learning. And so don't sell yourself short. If you hadn't listed geography as something that your kids were learning, they're already doing it. You probably just didn't know how that was integrated in. Yeah, go ahead. Absolutely.
And like his family is all still in Brazil, and so he's trying to teach the kids about Brazil and where his family immigrated from, the Azores to Brazil, and show them how they migrated and how we ended up in Macapá and that kind of thing. So
family history and geography is very much intertwined, and that not only does understanding it help you understand yourself and your family history, but it also helps you find what you need to find. You understand the history of that place. And well, why aren't there records available in Ireland anymore, like my family can't get, because of various historical events that affect that. Yeah.
It's Daily Overview.
Daily Overview is the Instagram account.
We just moved into, we live in Western Virginia in the Shenandoah Valley, and we just moved into a 200-year-old house that originally was on 5,000 acres, now it's only on 24. But there's a spring, like, literally coming out of the ground right behind
mm-hmm.
the house. So it's been really fascinating, like, to have that discussion about why that house. Because, you know, until 50 years ago, houses were oriented appropriately to the sun, which they aren't anymore. And
right.
I'd just like to discuss why our house is where it is on the land.
Yeah.
It's been really, it's been fun to do that with them.
That's great geography. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much. My website's pvmaps.com, and if you are on Twitter, I tweet occasionally. I tweeted, I need to retweet something that Julie said yesterday from the session. But at PVMaps is my Twitter handle. Thank you so much for being here, because now you're everywhere because you understand how geography is part of our life. So thank you so much.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.